This week, we're coming to you from two places at once. For half the show, we're in Berlin, covering the latest and greatest highlights, products, trends, and news from the IFA Technology Showcase. And simultaneously, half the show comes to you from London to run down some of the biggest news outside of IFA, including Microsoft buying Nokia and ice walls being built in Fukushima, Japan. Why, you ask? Well, all of that is coming up in a jam-packed episode 140. I love jam, let's do this. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from science and tech to IFA 2013 and enormous corporate spending. I'm your host, Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and I'm back from Japan. Hello! But I'm now in Berlin with half the Wired team. I'm actually heading over to meet our staff writer, Katie Collins, with whom I've been roaming the halls of the enormous annual technology orgy that is the IFA trade show. We'll be discussing the trends in Android-powered smartwatches, which we've seen and tested from Sony and Samsung over the last few days. We'll discuss the ultra-powerful quad-core smartphones and tablets we've been playing with, and the 4K tech we've seen across the industry. In fact, I've just played a video game on a phone being rendered in 4K and being wirelessly sent to an 80-inch Ultra HD telly. Pretty impressive stuff. But anyway, that's coming up in about 15 minutes. But first, it's over to Olivia_Solon and Kadim in the London studio to cover this week's top news stories outside of IFA. And it's been a pretty big week in the tech world. Over to you, Liv.
Thanks very much, Nate. This week has been an enormous week in tech news. In last week's podcast, we were talking about Steve Ballmer standing down from Microsoft, and we speculated that Nokia's CEO, Stephen Elop, might be brought in to replace him. Well, this week, we find out that Microsoft's actually bought Nokia for £4.6 billion. Kadim.
Yes, the whole tech world has been abuzz this week with the news that Microsoft spent $3.2 billion on the company and $1.4 billion on the patents. And people are calling Stephen Elop, who we previously wondered might be the new Microsoft CEO, a Trojan horse, which, you know, Microsoft sent off to Nokia to lay the groundwork for its eventual consumption.
Yeah. So what here? Yeah, they send him off because he originally worked at Microsoft and left in 2010. And so he actually did the deal with Microsoft, presumably.
Yeah. He left in 2010, became CEO of Yahoo. The following year, Yahoo started making Windows phones. Mm. Maybe that was the first hint. And now they've gone the whole hog. It's an interesting move. Microsoft is not the biggest player in the mobile market. Nokia certainly isn't. It's a sort of a shell of its former self. But it seems to be along the same lines of big software companies, the new giants of the 21st century, eating up the old mobile phone giants of the 20th century. Google bought Motorola and recently announced the Moto X. And now Nokia has been eaten up by Microsoft. Let's be honest, the Windows phone share of the market is tiny compared to the Android share of the market, so it's not quite the same as Google buying Moto X. But in the UK, Windows phone accounts for something like 10% of smartphone users. One really interesting take on this that I read was Farhad Manju in Slate, who he argued Windows is now dead, because this idea of Microsoft building a vertically integrated mobile phone business, now it has the hardware, it has the software, it's going to be doing everything in the same way that Apple does everything. That's a complete antithesis of the Microsoft philosophy. Windows was built to work on any device. The point was, no matter what computer you use, Windows is your friend and Windows is what you see. Apple was quite the opposite. Apple was like, we make the hardware, we make the software, we give you the whole experience. Now that philosophy, Microsoft's old philosophy, Farhad argues, is the Android philosophy. And Microsoft, which used to champion this idea, has now gone the way of Apple. It'll be interesting to see how other Windows phone manufacturers react to this and whether they'll continue to make Windows phones if Microsoft is going to create a more vertically integrated experience. And perhaps this is either a footnote that doesn't really make a difference to the Windows Phone market, or it's a way for Microsoft and Nokia to compete, you know, on a much stronger level with Android and with iOS.
Yeah, well, we had some interesting feedback from Philip Cowhig, I don't know if I've pronounced that correctly, who pointed us first of all to a blog post by his friend Christian, who goes by the pseudonym of Lord Chalfont of Gorilla, which I just love.
That's great.
But he said, we can't know what would have happened if Elop had not gone to Nokia in the first place, but once he was in, the sequence of events has felt more and more inevitable. And what has Microsoft gained? They have taken out a minor competitor while Elop destroyed a lot of the value, brackets, product innovation, software skills that Nokia had. Sure, Nokia was lagging behind, but now they're barely in the game. And Microsoft is still a minority player in the mobile space, although I still hope that they put a dent into Apple and Google just for the lols. A once great innovator is more or less destroyed. So some harsh words from Phil. If you have any thoughts on the Microsoft-Nokia deal, please do email us on podcast@wired.co.uk. Now, the next piece of news is the fact that the Brazilian government has announced plans to launch an anti-snooping email system. It wants to protect its civilians from the prying eyes of organisations such as the NSA. So, if you were to want to plan a highly sophisticated encrypted email system in the UK, who would you turn to?
Who would I turn to? I don't know.
Would it be the post office?
No, the post office is probably the last person I trust.
Exactly. Well, that's what the Brazilian government is doing. The authorities have been working with the national postal agency, Correios, to develop a system that would, first of all, guarantee the veracity of documents over the web. So I guess things like contracts, stuff you normally print out and have to sign, they're trying to develop a system that would allow this to happen easily over the web with the post office. However, in the wake of all the whistleblower revelations, Edward Snowden, about the extent of government digital surveillance, Brazil's communications ministry has now requested that the project is extended into a national email service, which would be encrypted and have its servers in Brazil.
At least with Gmail, you have the facade that you're not giving your emails directly to the government.
Well, no, at the moment, so Hotmail, Google, US companies, they are obliged to share data with the NSA. Yeah. So that's the argument is that
we might as well go straight to the source instead.
It's a different source. So in 2012 alone, Hotmail, Google, Facebook and Twitter provided law enforcement agencies in the US with information on 64,000 users. And the NSA can reportedly also tap into 3/4 of all the data flowing through the US internet, and also has legal power to access international communications, at least to order access to international communications. But yes, as you've kind of astutely pointed out, if you don't trust a government to not snoop on your emails, why would you trust your own government to not snoop on your emails? I mean, in the UK, we were completely up in arms about the idea of the Communications Data Bill, where the UK government has this snooping plans on our own emails. So it seems a slightly better of two evils.
I think in the modern world, if you want to report in the US, probably helpful not to use US services, so on and so forth. But if you're a Brazilian, I don't think this is going to give you any reassurances about how the Brazilian government will treat you. It might give you reassurances about the US government, but if I was going to write about Brazil, I'd probably want a Gmail account rather than the Brazilian national email service.
There are quite a few things that are wrong with this idea. I mean, in addition to the fact that it's the post office, I mean, come on, and the fact that it completely contravenes the idea of openness, international openness of the web. Thirdly, it's completely possible to encrypt email without having to build an entirely new national system. But what it does raise, which is an interesting point, is this idea of countries communicating to their citizens to not use US-based services, which could actually have quite an impact on cloud services over there. The German Minister of the Interior has actually warned companies not to use any services that go through US servers. And the French government is also working to build a domestic cloud infrastructure to compete with dominant US companies. So this could have quite a big impact on US cloud computing, even if some of these ideas are a little bit harebrained.
No, I think you're totally right. And people are already talking about the loss to the cloud services economy in the US because people are going to be moving away. People are already moving their files away. I find it interesting that it is government schemes to replace the US private network of cloud services.
I know.
Where are the French companies who are building a domestic cloud infrastructure and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I think it might be investment, a kind of tender process as opposed to the actual government building it. But anyway, Brazil says it's going to plan to launch this service in 2014. So quite a quick turnaround. So we'll see how that one pans out. The third piece of news, I think this is absolutely extraordinary. The Japanese have come up with an interesting way of preventing the radiation from the Fukushima nuclear meltdown from leaking out into the rest of the country. Kadim.
Yes, it is. Wait for it. An ice wall.
An ice wall?
Yes.
What does that even mean?
It's a Game of Thrones-esque ice wall, except under the ground and not built by magic. and also real. So, the Fukushima power plant, as we all know, destroyed in 2011 by, not the earthquake, I think it was okay after the earthquake, but then the massive tsunami. And that was generally a bad thing. So you've got all this radioactive material around, and you have to keep it from overheating. So you have to keep adding water all day, every day, nonstop. Yeah. Otherwise, this stuff, because it's radioactive material, just gets hotter and hotter, could catch fire, could do whatever. And as a result, for the last 2 years, we're basically dousing it with water, and there's about 300,000 tons of water now on site in about 1,000 tanks, and that's not a sustainable situation. They're leaking, basically. So you have all this radioactive contaminated water which is leaking around. Why is this a particular problem at Fukushima? Because it's not built on flat land. It's built on a slope, and it's right beside the sea. So groundwater seeps into the site, which is bad to begin with, but then the contaminated water flows out of the site into the sea. So all around a bad thing. How do you stop the flow of water? You build an ice wall. Okay, first, how do you build an ice wall? Essentially, you put pipes into the ground to a depth of around 30 meters, and you fill those pipes with coolant at about minus 40 degrees.
Okay.
And you freeze the land, essentially, around your site.
So has this ever been done before?
Yeah, this is actually not a new idea. It was previously used in the 90s at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, and it's generally a sort of a normal way of preventing groundwater from moving around. If you freeze the ground around it, the contaminated water won't be able to flow out. So it's, although it sounds amazing and ridiculous because it is, it's actually not entirely a new thing. So they're going to build this 1.4 kilometer ice wall. It's going to cost around £300 million. Interestingly, on the 7th of September, the International Olympic Committee is going to make a decision about which city will host the 2020 Olympics. It could be Istanbul, it could be Madrid, or it could be Tokyo. So people are speculating that part of this is Japan saying to the IOC, hey, we got it under control.
Maybe we can host the Winter Olympics.
In particular, the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who knows how to pronounce his second name, has said, instead of leaving this up to TEPCO, who are the company who run the Fukushima power plant, or run it into the ground, as it were, the government will step forward and take charge. So therefore, give us the Olympics, please.
How long do you need to keep it ice walled in?
Well, it's not a permanent solution because freezing the ground for years and years and years and years at a time isn't really practical. This is going to be built by about 2015, and they expect it to be there for a couple of years. At the same time, they are building a new water treatment plant on site to deal with all this contaminated water.
Okay.
Because ultimately, you can't just wall it in.
And
you need to get rid of it.
Yeah. So it's kind of buying time while they clear the mess up.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. I mean, really look forward to finding out more about that when that actually happens. Our final piece of news before we hand over to the team IFA, Katie and Nate, is the fact that T-Mobile and AT&T are having, I think, a slightly ridiculous squabble over the colour pink. More specifically, the colour magenta.
That changes everything.
Yes, it really does. So T-Mobile is suing a US prepaid mobile service owned by AT&T called IO over the use of the colour magenta. Now, this all started in early 2013 when T-Mobile announced it was launching a new prepaid no-contract mobile service. Very shortly after, AT&T responded by setting up a similar service called IO, A-I-O, which used the same or a very similar colour. T-Mobile's parent company, Deutsche Telekom, has been using the colour magenta, which it refers to as its famous magenta trademark, in its branding since the early 1990s, and in the US specifically since 2002. So, as a result, Deutsche Telekom thinks that the colour is a cornerstone of its brand identity. Would you agree?
So we're talking about the, you know, you have the T and then you have like the little pinkish dots.
Yeah.
It's that colour that they're talking about.
Yeah, yeah, that bright pink colour.
Okay, I guess I do. I think I do associate that with T-Mobile.
The interesting thing, I guess the important thing, is that Deutsche Telekom and T-Mobile have a number of trademarks registered which make specific reference to the magenta colour that they use. Like they actually have registered their specific, you know, that pink. And they cite loads of examples in the court filing they've made in the Texas court where this case is likely to be heard, where they've used the colour in their advertising and branding. But the icing on the irritation cake seems to be the fact that IO has audaciously chosen to colour its coverage map, i.e. the map that shows, you know, where you get signal for the network, with magenta, as opposed to orange, which is the colour normally associated with AT&T.
That sounds suspicious.
A little bit suspicious. I mean, if you look on the website on wired.co.uk, we've written this story, and you can see both of the coverage maps. And in my, let's say, untrained opinion, my untrained eye, I would say that the IO colour is a bit more subdued. It's a bit darker. It's less vivid. And to me, it feels like this argument is a bit like when you squabble over the laundry when, in fact, there's a bigger simmering issue in the relationship. T-Mobile is pissed off that IO exists at all and is unleashing legal hell where it can. I think it's a bit weird. It's kind of like if Dell and HP fought over the colour blue. I mean, they're both in the same space. They both use blue in their logos.
Yeah, have they not fought over it? Maybe it's time. I'm getting confused. As a consumer, I don't know what to think.
I mean, Intel and IBM, Facebook and Twitter, everyone's using blue. This is a confusing space.
Oh, but no, Facebook and Twitter have a different blue.
But they have a different blue. But, you know, I think, in my opinion, IO and T-Mobile have a different magenta, but that's, I guess, what the case rests upon.
I'm going to have to see you in court, Liv. I'm going to take this all the way to the top.
All the way to what top?
The Texas court, obviously.
Hell yeah.
That's the place to be for this kind of litigation.
I object. Anyway, on that terrible, terrible note, we're going to end the news this week and head back over to Nate and Katie in Berlin for the lowdown on what's coming out of the IFA Tech Trade Show.
Thanks, Liv. So we're back at IFA 2013 in Berlin. Katie Collins is here.
Hello.
Now, we've been here for, 3 days?
3 days, yes.
3 days of IFA, which is kind of a colloquialism for hell, I think, in some ways. We've seen quite a lot of new announcements. We've got hands-on with quite a lot of stuff. And I want to start by talking about smartwatches. Now, we've separately seen two different models. We've seen the Samsung.
Yep.
Samsung announced the Galaxy Gear.
Yes, they did.
Smartwatch, an Android-powered watch that connects to a phone. And Sony also showed off its SW2 Android-powered watch, which also connects to a phone. Now, this is a trend that we're really starting to see now. I mean, Sony's actually been making these for a few years, and I remember a few years ago, actually, I think it was LG made one that cost like £1,000 and was exclusive to Orange on a contract that apparently never went anywhere. But since over the last 12 months, we've had a lot of talk about Google potentially getting into making smartwatches. There's a lot of rumour that Apple is going to make the iWatch possibly next year. This is kind of the first time that we've really been able to see what smartwatches are beginning to look like and might look like in the future. So what was your takeaway from the Samsung, Casey?
So I kind of had an idea of what to expect with the Galaxy Gear, just because there have been so many leaks beforehand.
Yeah.
And it actually ended up looking almost exactly like the leaked picture that we saw last week.
It's quite fat.
Yeah.
Fat
and in all fairness, it wasn't as fat as I thought it was going to be. And when I tried it on, it was not heavy at all. But still, it wasn't totally comfortable either, just because, you know, when you have like a big thing on your wrist, it means that the wristband around it has to be quite stiff. and it was too big for me. And I've probably got an average sized wrist.
The Sony one is definitely smaller. I've tried both of them, and the Sony one is, I would say, slightly smaller because it actually doesn't have some of the features that the Galaxy has. Why don't you run down what the top line features of the Gear?
So the Gear, it's kind of its main appeal is obviously that it links up with your Samsung phone, and it can from there it can give you all your notifications and stuff when you're getting messages and when you get calls. It has its own camera. It has a camera built into the wrist strap.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons it's so large.
Yeah, yeah, and you can use that to take pictures and also to record video. The other things that it can do, basically, the one thing that I thought was kind of most interesting is that you can actually answer and make calls through it. It's almost like a Bluetooth device. It is a Bluetooth device. But
now this is something you can't do on the Sony, and it's quite weird because the way they've designed it is that there's an accelerometer in it that detects motion, and when you sort of raise your hand up against the side of your face, that answers the call.
Yes. So it's got this kind of, it's basically responds to your gestures, and it's pretty, like, its functionality is, you know, like, they've clearly kind of put a lot of thought into this, and functionality is kind of great as far as I can see, as long, of course, as you've got a Samsung device that works with it.
It's very much a companion device to the Note 3, I think. So they also showed off the Note 3, which we'll come back to later on when we talk about tablets that we've seen, because that was an interesting launch. But it's both for Sony and for Samsung, they've sort of pitched this as, like, you know, this is to go along with a new device that they've announced. So The Samsung, like, it has a very small screen, but it's a monochrome screen. It's kind of black and white, a bit like you know, like a screen of a Kindle in that sense. It's not e-ink, it's still an LCD, but that sort of black and white sort of appeal. Looks quite good. They reckon it'll last for, I think they said, 25 hours.
Yeah, 25 plus hours.
Of constant use, which is actually very disappointing, I think,
and
for
they,
a watch.
They kind of, they at the announcement, they sort of said, they were like, we know battery life is really important to you, and so we are very pleased to announce that it can last for 25 or more hours.
Yeah.
And it was just, it's like, yeah, obviously smartphones don't tend to last that long.
Bit disappointing.
But, like, this is a watch, and like the thing that we've been saying is if a watch, if they're going to build a watch, it needs to have good battery.
Well, Sony, contrary to that, then it kind of one-upped, I think, in that sense. So the Sony has a colour screen, but you can't make and receive calls through it directly. So it doesn't have a speaker, it doesn't have a microphone. But it does have apps that can be downloaded from Android. So there's a Facebook app, there's a Twitter app, you know, there's a Gmail app. So you can do your email on it, you can check Facebook, you can post statuses.
Yeah.
If a call comes in on a phone that is connected to the Sony watch, it's displayed on the screen.
Yeah.
And you can connect it to not just the Sony phones, but also any compatible Android phone. I think it needs to be like Jelly Bean.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. No, the Samsung has similar things. It has sort of, I think, it has like a big bunch of apps that you can use with it at the moment.
Yeah.
And again, like, you know, if you're doing something, it sort of mirrors your screen, like, through like a relay. So if you're like looking at something on your watch and then you pick up your phone will automatically display whatever you've been looking at on the watch. Because, you know, like, maybe you've seen an email and, like, you've looked at it and then you want to, and you're like, I need to reply. And then you just pick up your phone and it'll be there straight away, which is quite good.
Yeah. Yeah, Sony's is a little different to that. But the battery life is much longer. Yeah. So Sony reckons it'll last for about 3 days, you know, in use. And possibly up to 7 days with, like, much less consistent use. So a week is far more exciting, potentially. Certainly 3 days is even better, obviously, if you're using it all the time. Okay, so I think we've pretty reasonably summed those up. The two release dates, I think Sony's is going to be out in September. We don't have a confirmed UK price, but we're expecting something around the sort of £130 to £150 mark. Samsung's, I think, again, no UK specific release date, but we're expecting September to October for around about £190.
Yeah.
Around those points, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move on. Let's talk about some of the new tablets and smartphones we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen a continuing trend in quad-core, ultra-powerful devices.
Yeah.
Sony announced the Z1, which is its quad-core, I think 2.2 gigahertz Snapdragon 800 processor, 5-inch screen, insanely powerful, 20.7 megapixel camera on the back, ludicrously high spec. We've also seen the Galaxy Note 3, which has a quad-core processor, 2.3 gigahertz, 3 gigabytes of RAM, I think, possibly?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
2 or 3 gigabytes, actually, I can't remember off the top of my head now which those are. 5.7 inch screen. And we've also, we've got the G2, although you've been using the LG's G2 for quite some time.
I've got it right here, yeah.
There it is. I don't know when that's out. When is that out?
I'm not sure.
Okay, soon.
Soon.
But again, another quad-core beast. And what was really interesting is on LG's booth, I went over and I saw this demo. They didn't have any real signposting around it, but LG was running a demo of a game running at 4K resolution on a phone, being wirelessly sent over in real time to a 4K Ultra HD television.
Wow.
But it was all being rendered on the phone. You know, so Xbox and PlayStation 3 still rendering in 1080p, and the demo I saw was being rendered at four times that resolution at 4K on a phone, being wirelessly sent. And I played it, and it was an Epic Citadel game, which is like a bit of a tech demo, but still, you know, pretty much cutting-edge graphics.
Yeah.
Being rendered in real time at that level. It was pretty mad. But you got hands-on with the Note 3.
I did,
yeah. What was your impression? It's a massive phablet.
It is. Although, like, nowadays, there are so many big phones around, it doesn't seem that huge anymore. Like, I remember, like, when the first Note came out, and everyone was like, what is this? This is huge.
Yeah.
Like, this is absolutely ridiculous.
And they're so popular in Asia. Like, you see
so
it all
popular,
the time.
Yeah. And, like, I think, you know, now they're phablets are outselling laptops and tablets in Asia. Like, you know, it's crazy. But, like, the Note 3, so, like, it's, you know, it's, I think it's 2.2 inches bigger than the last one.
And thinner and lighter as well.
Yeah, so it's basically like they've just taken it and fine-tuned it.
It comes across as basically a giant Galaxy S4 with the S Pen that's got some new features in it, which is kind of like an extremely posh, stylish sort of thing.
Yeah, and I guess it's also probably worth mentioning the kind of the back, which they've redone. And like Samsung's known for like people say that their phones sometimes feel a bit cheap. Because I usually have these like plastic backs on, and now it's got this like lovely sort of leather feeling back, and actually it's quite nice.
Yeah,
it's got sort of stitching on the edge, and it's the same on the Note that's on the Note 10.1.
It's an impressive device. You know, personally, I still think that, I mean, we say phablet, and for anyone who doesn't know, that's like, it's a sort of portmanteau of phone and tablet.
Yeah.
It's sort of in between the large smartphone and the small tablet sort of size.
We all hoped that it would just go away, the word, but it seems to have stuck, and now we have to use it.
I think they put it in the dictionary recently.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
So that was quite nice. There was also Acer's Liquid S2.
Yes, yeah.
Which actually, we didn't mention this, it records video in 4K.
Yeah.
Again, four times resolution of HD.
Yeah, so that's the Note. Yeah, the Note does and the...
The Note does as well,
And the Acer phone as well.
So the trend of massive phones is definitely not going away. And these things are stocked to the gills, I think is the expression, of the very, very sort of bleeding edge side of tech. And, you know, certainly what's available and affordable to consumers. Mm. You know, pretty impressive stuff. We also saw a new 10.1 Note as well, which has exactly the same specs as the Note 3, but just in a 10-inch body instead of a sort of 5.7-inch body, which I thought was pretty cool. And LG announced a new tablet, sort of similar size to the iPad Mini.
Yeah. That's kind of also been a trend as well. I've seen a few sort of like 7 and 8-inch tablets at the show, I think. Toshiba have just sort of unveiled their 8-inch Windows 8.1 tablet.
Right, yeah.
Who else? Like, there's another one as well. There's another 8-inch tablet, kind of, I think it's from someone else I've seen.
The trend's definitely not going away. I mean, the iPad Mini outsells the regular-sized iPad by quite a significant margin. At this point, and Google's Nexus 7 is a strong competitor for a lot of these because it's a very, you know, it's a pretty high spec device, but actually only costs just under £200, so it's very valuable.
I think like I use that as like as a kind of a benchmark, because like when I think about things like the Galaxy Gear being around the same price and you know, I'm just like, that. How can that be that you can get this like incredible, like really highly specced kind of wonderful tablet? And obviously the Galaxy Gear doesn't have these kind of really high specs and doesn't offer all the same kind of amazing functionality as a tablet. But I think actually it changes the whole bottom end of the market, because, you know, there's no reason, you can spend very little money and still get an amazing thing. And it means that there's not really any excuse for people being like, oh well, the specs aren't that great, but you know, it's cheap, like you know it's I think it's a brilliant device.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's definitely a continuing trend. The last thing I wanted to mention was something totally mad that I tried out from Sony, which has shown off this £1,300 wearable cinema set, which is a head-mounted display. If you've ever seen the Oculus Rift, it's not entirely dissimilar to that in terms of design. It's like a large, although pretty lightweight and very comfortable device that you wear over your head. It covers your eyes, and it has HD screen on the inside of it. It supports 3D, and it's kind of like watching this cinema screen, like quite a large cinema screen, but from about sort of 20, 30 sort of steps away, which I tried out. You look mental.
Yeah, but...
You look very, very bizarre wearing
yeah,
it. But it's the first of these types of products, and I've been trying these for years, and they're always incredibly disappointing.
Okay.
And this is the first time that I put it on and thought, actually, that looks pretty good.
Yeah.
It looks pretty good. The thing is, it's £1,300. I would never buy one.
No.
I don't think I could ever realistically recommend anyone buy one except the hardcore cinema addict who for some reason maybe lives with a partner who despises everything they love.
Yeah.
Maybe it's good market. But it's kind of interesting to see Sony sort of continuing experimenting in that field, because maybe if there's enough adoption or at least enough interest, it can be something that they develop and the price comes
down.
And it supports gaming as well, so I wouldn't be totally surprised if we see something like that, if not the same product, be compatible with the PlayStation 4 when that comes out in November. Okay, so I think that's a summary of our trends. We've got stuff on the site on wired.co.uk if you want to read obviously more about these, if you want to see any of the pictures that we've done hands-on with all the products that we've talked about today, so you can see those in glorious detail. If you go to wired.co.uk and search for IFA, IFA 2013, you'll find all of our stories there. We're going to do the feedback section of the show from Berlin. This comes in from Samir, who says, "Dear Wired team, wanted to drop you a quick note to comment on your podcast 137 and the section regarding the future of BlackBerry as a company. I agree with Nate's analysis that BlackBerry probably needs to consider various options to stay relevant. One idea might be for LinkedIn to buy the hardware business and come up with a LinkedIn phone like the Google phone. Given the similar target customers of the two products, this might lead to a business-friendly communication device. My two cents, Samir." Very interesting idea, although I don't think LinkedIn could possibly afford the Nokia's hardware business, despite its troubles. You know, BlackBerry actually does a huge amount on the software side, the business services side.
Yes.
You know, and it actually wouldn't surprise me if, you know, perhaps they stopped making phones, but they continued making software and security solutions. What do you think? LinkedIn phone, would you want that?
I am not really generally a fan of phones that are based around a single social network or a single sort of feature like that. I just think that, you know, they've become irrelevant very quickly, and people don't use their phone generally for just one thing. And, you know, if you just look at the HTC First, which...
the Facebook phone, which
never really saw the light of day, to be honest.
Interesting idea, though, Sam.
Yeah, it is.
And, you know, they could certainly partner. You know,
yes.
You could certainly see
that would be a good partnership. It would be a solid idea.
Arthur writes in and says, "I'm a regular listener of your podcast and absolutely love it." Hooray! Yay! Love that. "I didn't listen much over the summer, so I've been doing my wired.co.uk marathon on my commutes to and from work. It's made my return to work after my summer holiday so much more bearable." Hooray! He says, continues to say, "Saw on Facebook that Duncan Gear has been in Sweden, where I also live, for a year now. Any plans to have Duncan as a guest presenter on the show?" No. Although, not that we'd be opposed to having Duncan on. Duncan kind of does weekend writing for us and writes a lot about sort of tech and environmental sciences and things at the weekends. So certainly we could get Duncan back on. Maybe I'll drop him a line and see if he wants to come on. Purely for you, Arthur. And finally, Igor writes in and says, "Hello, really like your podcast, but please bring the outtakes back. All the best, Igor." So we used to do this.
Yeah.
And Igor is not the first or the second or third or fourth or fifth person that we've had writing in saying, you know, where are the outtakes kind of at the end of the show? We usually put something that that we chopped out of the program at the end of the show,
and we a little quip.
Yeah, we stopped doing it, which is my choice. But you know, we get so many people writing in. So from next week, pleased to announce, the outtakes are coming back. For those of you who listen all the way through to the end, that's your little treat. So there you go. Very finally, just a last note I wanted to mention is that we had a lot of feedback that our RSS feed for the podcast had broken for some people. We had some helpful notes from Dave and from Tom as well. And Tom's actually a friend of mine who, coincidentally, I'm having a burger with on Monday, and I had no idea listened to the show. So, hi, Tom. they one of many people who wrote in to comment on the fact that after we'd made a change to the RSS feed, for some people it stopped updating. It also stopped updating in iTunes, which is... a massive shame, but we do hear that it has been fixed and should be pushing out to people very soon. So hopefully it will be sorted by the time you listen to this, or maybe because you're listening to this, it is sorted. So apologies for anyone who is affected badly. That's going to do it for the rest of the show today. Katie, it's been a pleasure.
It has.
As always, yes. We'll be back in the studio next week. I'm going to be back in Berlin after returning to London because Apple has announced its iPhone launch and the European version of that is taking place in Berlin. So I'm back in London for 2 days and coming back out to Berlin for that. So we'll have a report from Apple's launch next week. So that'll do it. Katie, thank you very much.
Thanks, Nate.
See you next week.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android, tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.